rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, they're at it. They are at it, full tilt boogie. Over on the Daily Kos, right-wingers posting, oh, this is all the fault of the first responders at the state and local level. Rush Limbaugh, oh, it's all the fault of the failed welfare state, yes. I'm telling you, I'm on all these websites, on all these mailing lists, rather. And I am hearing from the right-wingers who are talking to the right-wing talk show hosts, thinking that I'm on their lists. And here are the, broadly speaking, here are the talking points that you're going to hear today if you happen to have the misfortune of tuning into right-wing talk radio anywhere in the United States. These going to local talk show hosts as well as national talk show hosts. They will all be singing from the same playbook now that Karl Rove is supervising the Bush administration's response to Hurricane Katrina. And, of course, Karl Rove's M.O. is smash and smear, especially if it's a woman. Okay, here are the talking points. A. Local officials failed to cross some T's and dot some I's, and that led to a slow response by the feds. Yeah. This goes back to a Washington Post story, and Media Matters did a piece on this that, I'm quite sure it was Media Matters, that is really quite thoughtful and quite actually important. That talks about this article in the Washington Post. What about this senior administration official? Well, let me just remind you about senior administration officials. You know, when the Washington Post in the past has quoted a senior administration official, very often it's simply been Karl Rove. I mean, we just know this, right? There's been enough times that this has been outed, and Karl Rove is, you know, good buddies and very cozy with a lot of these reporters. After all, we're all in it for corporate profit, right? And Karl Rove, you know, feeding folks to these reporters saying, well, you know, here's a little gem for you. I'm sure you're going to want to know about this, and I'm sure you'll want to know about that, and here's a little tip that you should know about, and by the way, and, you know, they don't always turn out to be true. Sometimes they are. For example, Valerie Plame works for the CIA. When Karl Rove leaked that, and George Bush had to come out and say,
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So David Brock from Media Matters has written a letter to the Washington Post ombudsman, Michael Gettler, ombudsman at washpost.com. And he says, I'm writing to express my deep concern over the recent use of a dishonest anonymous source. What? Karl Rove could be dishonest? A senior administration official in the Bush White House might lie to the newspaper? As you've surely become aware, writes David Brock, on September 4th, the Post printed an article titled, Many Evacuate But Thousands Still Waiting, White House Shifts Blame to State and Local Officials. In that article, an anonymous senior Bush official sought to dismiss criticism of the administration's response to Hurricane Katrina by contending falsely that, as of Saturday, September 3rd, Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco still had not declared a state of emergency. In fact, it turns out, end of quote from David Brock's article, in fact, it turns out that is a lie. Not only on September 3rd was there a state of emergency declared by Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco, there was on September 2nd, and there was on September 1st, and there was on August 30th, and there was on August 29th, and 28th, and 27th, and in fact it was on August 26th, long before the hurricane made landfall, that she actually declared a state of emergency. But a senior administration official in the Bush White House told the Washington Post, it wasn't until Saturday, the September 3rd, that she declared a state of emergency. That quote, now the Washington Post, to their credit, has run a retraction, a correction, but they haven't run what I think, frankly, is the big story. The big story on this thing, which is that the administration is lying to the press in an attempt to do spin control. So David Brock saying to the Washington Post, maybe you should reveal your source here. This, because the source has become the story again. Somebody in the White House, some senior administration official, has lied to the Washington Post, and the Washington Post published their lie, and now right-wing talk show hosts all across America for 3 days have been repeating this lie, and they still are, even though the Washington Post has printed a retraction of the lie. They're still able to say, you know, the Washington Post, it said, and it did say. And some senior administration official responsible for that lie, hey, Washington Post, New York Times, media out there, this is a story. Who is the senior administration official who leaked a lie to the Washington Post?
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah. Now, in response to this, and this is just the beginning. By the way, I was reading you the list. That's where I started. That number A on the list, number one, local officials failed to cross T's and dot I's. Kathleen Blanco was late in asking for a state of emergency, and therefore the feds were late. A lie. No, they're also going to be saying, in a time of crisis, we have to support our president. And if you don't support our president in time of crisis, it's because you hate America. You're going to hear that. You're going to hear that the primary responsibility for this crisis must be borne by the mayor of New Orleans and the state of Louisiana, the governor of Louisiana, these two Democrats, because they were closest to the emergency. Now, to that, I would simply say there's a reason why they call these things disasters, because they are beyond the ability of a local organization like a city, and even beyond. There's a reason why we have FEMA, because there are things that are beyond the ability of a state to respond to. When you've got a million people needing to be evacuated, you've got all these displaced persons, you've got possibly as many as 10,000 people dead, you've got a major crisis coming in a city that is essential to the commerce of the United States. New Orleans isn't just this nice place where they have jazz in the French Quarter, like the cons would like you to think. New Orleans is the port city for the Mississippi River. I mean, New Orleans is responsible for an enormous amount of trade in the United States. And it's absolutely critical in that regard, in fact. I mean, it goes way beyond just, maybe we're going to lose some music or something like that. Here, from today's Wall Street Journal, an article by Paul Glader. The price of steel used to make cars and industrial equipment is expected to rise by as much as 20% in coming months. Why? Why would steel all across the United States rise by 20%? Because New Orleans flooding has limited the supply and distribution of raw materials such as liquid hydrogen and scrap steel. Why? Because they come up the Mississippi River. Liquid hydrogen, he notes, is needed to make higher quality steel such as galvanized or cold rolled coils, which are used in products from auto panels to garage doors. Scrap steel is used to make new steel. As buyers began stockpiling to avoid higher prices and shortages, prices could escalate by as much as $80 a ton on such products, according to some analysts. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. Although others forecast a more modest increase, currently hot rolled coil, which is used to make cold rolled coil, costs about $500 a ton, and concrete reinforcing bars, also used in construction, is expected to rise. You've got a city that is at the center, at the heart of American commerce, at the absolute heart of America's commerce. So back to the talking points. Number four, the massive death toll of poor and black people in New Orleans is the result of a failed welfare state. This Rush Limbaugh was apparently ranting on this yesterday. Well, the majority of the people in New Orleans, sorry to inform you, Rush, were employed. They were what's called the working poor and the lower part of the working middle class. Just because somebody is black does not mean that they're unemployed and on welfare. I know that, you know, Limbaugh and most of the cons think that's true, but in fact, it's not. In fact, New Orleans was a huge labor pool a resource, a labor resource for all these folks who are working on the Mississippi River and the other port facilities. It's funny, I got an email the other day from a guy in Michigan saying, I run a company and I provide jobs to 15 people or whatever it was. And I'm thinking, okay, let me... See, this is how brilliantly they've captured the language. I've started 7 businesses in my life that have employed, I don't know, over the 30 years since I started them, probably several hundred people. The most people I've ever employed at one given moment in one of the businesses that I ran was probably around 25. I never thought of it as I am creating jobs for people. Because I knew as a businessman that I was hiring somebody to do something to make more money than I had to pay them. I mean, that's what you do in business. If you're running an assembly line and you're making, you know, herbal tea or whatever it may be, and you figure out what's it going to cost to make this stuff, and you know how much can you pay for the labor to make it? Typically, I mean, the ratios in American industry vary from business to business, but in some industries, you expect that each employee is going to produce 10 times their salary. Some employees are expected to produce 100 times their salary. Some employees are expected to produce 1,000 times their salary. The bottom line is that we're not making jobs for people. We're having people do things that help build businesses, that help create wealth for the owners of the business. It's very simple. It's a fine thing that people have employment. I'm all in favor of it. But let's be honest here. Employers don't create jobs. They hire people to do things for them that make them money. We have had a complete reversal. You know, 20 years ago in America, 25 years ago, before Reagan came along, everybody understood this. In fact, there were debates about, you know, are we exploiting labor? And how do you avoid exploiting labor? Well, you have organized labor. You have reasonable pay. And try and get people reasonable benefits and things like that. So, anyhow, this is a failed welfare state. Give me a break. This is no time to criticize the government, variation on B. F, the hurricane was an act of God that could not have been anticipated. This was their first try, you'll recall. And then G, this kind of contradicts F. Hurricanes of this intensity happen every year or so in the Gulf of Mexico, proving this is not the result of global warming. Right. I heard Al Gore last night speak here in Portland, Oregon. One of the most brilliant presentations I've ever heard on global warming. He's doing a roadshow around the country. If you have an opportunity to hear Al Gore speak, do it. This was absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. And global warming is real, and it is a real problem. Not just a real problem. It's a real disaster. Hurricane Katrina should have been named Hurricane Global Warming, because that's a big chunk of what it's all about. So anyhow, Howard Dean comes out. He has a statement on this. We're going to try and get Larry Johnson on the line here, our friendly CIA officer, to tell you what's up with FEMA. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Freedom. Welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. It's the place where smart people get their news. Larry Johnson's with us. Larry is the CEO and co-founder of Berg Associates, a consulting firm that helps corporations and government manage threats posed by terrorism and money laundering. And he's also previously an intelligence officer with the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you here.
Thank you, sir.
Larry, there is this thing called the National Response Plan. Tell us what that is.
It was drafted and finalized in December of 2004. It basically puts the Department of Homeland Security at the top, being in charge of all responses by the federal government to terrorism, incidents of terrorism, or national disasters such as Hurricane Katrina. And every single member of the federal government's executive agencies, from Department of Defense, Department of State, down to Department of Agriculture, signed off on that document. And what it lays out very clearly is how the federal government is supposed to respond. It's a plan for dealing with an emergency.
Like Hurricane Katrina.
Exactly. And in it, it makes it very clear there are two routes the government can go. Either they can wait for a request from the government, or if it's such a serious incident, they can act proactively. In the case of Katrina, it's clear that the governor of Louisiana and the governor of Mississippi initiated the request per this national response plan. That arrived on the desk of the president Saturday morning, August 27th. The president later that day issued an emergency declaration under the national response plan, which then put FEMA on the hot seat and Homeland Security on
okay,
the hot
so
seat.
Okay, so let's just, you know, to clarify the timeline here, on Saturday, as 20, the hurricane, on the 26th.
27th.
Well, it was the governor's letter is dated the 26th.
So actually, there was an initial declaration of emergency in Louisiana on the 26th.
I see.
She followed it up with a letter to Bush on the 27th.
Okay, so on the 26th, which is Friday or Saturday?
Friday's the 26th.
Friday the 26th, she declares an emergency locally in the state of Louisiana.
Right.
The 27th, she sends a letter to George Bush saying, please institute the national response plan, essentially. Please help us out. We got to... And Bush declares, and later on that day, on the 27th, Bush declares
a state of emergency
and hands the thing off to Michael Chertoff at Department of Homeland Security, right?
That's correct. In fact, in that letter, what Blanco said was, I request direct federal assistance for work and services to save lives and protect property.
Okay, and so then Chertoff has this thing on Saturday. What does he do with it?
Essentially nothing, because they wait until Monday before Mike Brown, the head of FEMA, sends Chertoff a memo saying, okay, well, it looks like we'll need about 1,000 people down there. Now, remember, this is while the hurricane is underway, and Brown doesn't call for deploying anybody until at least Wednesday the 31st. Now, what was supposed to happen under this national response plan is their personnel were to be deployed to the operations centers in Louisiana and Baton Rouge to be a liaison both with the state and local officials, as well as to provide expertise on what they should be doing to be able to stand there and say, hey, there are issues that you're not addressing, such as evacuation, et cetera. And when Sunday morning came and the mayor of New Orleans ordered a mandatory evacuation, we note that FEMA at that point on Sunday blocked the use of Amtrak for evacuating people. So instead of the Federal Emergency Management Agency and Department of Homeland Security being at the forefront helping to evacuate, helping to organize the response to this crisis, they were asleep at the switch.
Larry, we've got about 30 seconds left. Any idea why FEMA would cut the emergency telephone lines in Jefferson Parish?
They got caught up with bureaucracy and procedure instead of dealing with the threat to Americans. And this is ultimately...
This is nothing malicious. This is just a screw-up.
It's a failure of leadership, and it's just bureaucrats being bureaucrats. That's why you got to have strong leadership at the time to make some of these folks do what common sense would tell you to
well,
do.
Well, hey, we've got a guy who ran the Arabian Horse Association for 11 years before he was fired.
Yeah, so if you can't even deal with horses who aren't the brightest animals in the world and you get fired, God help us if you put him in where he is now.
Yeah, and literally, God help us all.
Yes, sir.
Larry Johnson. Larry is with Berg Associates, BERG-associates.com. Larry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 28 minutes past the hour. I got to tell you, when we come back, exactly what is happening to the firefighters from all over the United States who are volunteering with FEMA, and what is happening right now as we speak in the Astrodome in Texas. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now believe in yourself, my friends. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 27 minutes before the hour, more or less, 33 minutes after, and some seconds coming up on 34. Two quick things before we get to Howard Dean's response and to your phone calls. Today, as we speak, at this moment, in the Houston Astrodome, where yesterday Barbara Bush so charitably observed that, well, you know, those people were poor anyway. I mean, you know, it's just, why should you? Well, actually, you know, she says it so much better than I do.
And so many of the people in the arenas here, you know, were underprivileged anyway. This is working very well for them.
So it's working out very well for them. Looks like it might work out very well for the U.S. Army as well, because as we speak, they're doing a recruiting fair inside the Astrodome. Yes, indeed. The military is conducting a job fair in the Astrodome. If people sign up thinking that they are going to be sent, say they sign up with the National Guard, thinking that they'll be sent to New Orleans to help with the cleanup, they could just as easily find themselves deployed to Iraq. Anybody who's ever been in the service will tell you that, you know, I mean, everybody has these stories. When you first go and talk to the recruiter, they give you this list of, oh, here's the 186 different job categories, and you can take your first, second, and third choices and put them down, and we'll do our very best to make sure that you get that job. And here's the places in the world where you might be deployed, and we'll try and give you your preference. Bah. You don't beat the Reaper. Sorry. Maybe if you're the son of a United States congressman like George Herbert Walker Bush's son, George W., then maybe you can get sent to wherever you want to go. But otherwise, forget it. And even if they sign up thinking that it's temporary duty, they could get, you know, like for 1 year like that, they could get recalled over and over and over again. Find out more information about this at unitedforpeace.org. In the meantime, over 1,000 firefighters have been pulled together in Atlanta. On my local program in Portland, Oregon here this morning, the mother of one of these firefighters called in. She said her son has been flown from Portland, Oregon, a fireman. With all his firefighting gear and everything, he was flown down to Atlanta, then he was flown over to Fort Worth, and then back to Atlanta, and then back to Fort Worth. Well, here's the story. She said he's having a fine time. He's getting great meals, room service in the Marriott, and a free rental car, and all of it's being paid for with our tax dollars. But they won't let him into New Orleans. This from the Salt Lake Tribune, article by Lisa Rosetta. Fire crews to hand out flyers for FEMA. Not long after some 1,000, by Dateline Atlanta, not long after some 1,000 firefighters sat down for 8 hours of training, the whispering began, "What are we doing here?" As New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin pleaded on national television for firefighters, his own are exhausted after working around the clock for a week, a battalion of highly trained men and women sat idle Sunday in a muggy Sheraton Hotel conference room in Atlanta. This is a week after the hurricane, keep in mind. Many of the firefighters assembled from Utah and throughout the United States by FEMA thought they were going to be deployed as emergency workers. Instead, they've learned they're going to be community relations workers, officers for FEMA. PR flex. Their job? To disseminate flyers. Yes, you too can pass out flyers telling people what a great job FEMA's doing. On Monday, some firefighters stuck in the staging area at the Sheraton Hotel peeled off their FEMA-issued shirts, stuffed them in their backpacks, and said they refused to support or represent the federal agency. The firefighters, several of whom were from Utah, keep in mind this is a Salt Lake City newspaper, were told to bring backpacks, sleeping bags, first aid kits, and meals ready to eat. They were told to prepare for austere conditions. Many of them came with awkward fire gear and expected to wade in floodwaters, sift through rubble, and save lives. Texas firefighter says, "We got people here who are search and rescue certified, paramedics, hazmat certified, and we're sitting here in a sexual harassment class while there are victims in Louisiana who haven't yet been contacted?" Yes, a sexual harassment class before they send them out to pass out flyers to people and be community relations officers for FEMA. They want to make sure that they know that they can't hit on any cute woman that they encounter, or man, as the case may be, when they're out there passing out the flyers. And now here's where it gets truly bizarre. The last two paragraphs of this article in the Salt Lake City Tribune. Firefighters say they want to brave the heat, the debris-littered roads, the poisonous cottonmouth snakes and fire ants, and travel into pockets of Louisiana where many people have yet to receive emergency aid. After all, that's what they signed up for. That's what firefighters do. But, writes Lisa Rosetta, as specific orders began arriving to the firefighters in Atlanta, a team of 50 Monday morning quickly was ushered onto a flight headed to Louisiana. Okay, so they're sitting in these classes, these sexual harassment classes. They're learning how to pass out flyers. But all of a sudden, hey, we need 50 guys. You know, they look like firemen. You know, if you've got the equipment, if you've got an outfit, if you've got a uniform, you got a badge, you got a, you know, a tank you can put on your back, we want you right now. 50, a team of 50 Monday morning. We only want 50. A team of 50 Monday morning was quickly called up and ushered onto a flight headed for Louisiana. The crew's first assignment? To stand beside President Bush as he tours devastated areas. To stand beside President Bush as he tours devastated areas. I'm telling you, Karl Rove has been put in charge of this thing. And just like with everything else, it's all going to be about spin. It's not at all going to be about reality. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bennett in Newburgh, New York on the line. Hey, Bennett, what's on your mind today? How are you doing?
There's so much on my mind. Actually, there's more on my mind having listened to you in the last few minutes than it was when I first called. Particularly, I'd like to just add a little bit of information about that memo that your previous guest, I forget his name, talked about.
Larry Johnson, the CIA officer.
Right. Okay, now I'm reading from an AP dispatch right here. This is the way Brown described the event in New Orleans to his superior. He said this, quote, near catastrophic event. Now, this is 5 hours after it happened. We must handle it in a way, and again, I'm quoting, to convey a positive image, unquote, about the government's response. Image. It's unbelievable what's going on, and I just think that
Bennett, pardon my interrupting you, but I just had this all makes perfect sense. These guys don't believe in government having any protective capacity. They don't think the government should provide for old age, as in Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. They don't believe that government should provide any sort of social safety net, as in aid to families with dependent children, or food stamps, or unemployment insurance. They don't believe that government should be doing basically anything other than having a national defense. And they're very proud of that, by the way.
Tom, it's scarier than that. They don't believe in reality. Well, they believe in image. They believe in their own con. They believe in their own sham.
You're right.
That's
and in
the
fact,
scary
they
part.
Refer to the press as the reality-based media out there.
Well, there's one thing we could do to give them an unbelievable dose of reality right between the eyes. And I hate to use this opportunity to promote something I believe in even prior to this, a pre-existing agenda, if you will. But I think there's more reason than ever to show up on September 24th with a huge sign that says the buck stops here, pointing right to that damn Capitol building.
Well, to the White House. Yeah.
Right to the White House. Yeah. With their motto is the buck stops there. You know, it's mind-boggling that the amount of spin, as you pointed out in your opening, about how they're all so cohesive in their attack on the state and the federal, I mean, the state and the mayor in New Orleans. When even if these people, even if you take the worst-case scenario and say that these people not only were incompetent, but let's even say they were malevolent. Let's say that the mayor and the governor down there deliberately said, hey, listen, let's not tell the federal government about this. Let's be quiet because we want to get all that money to rebuild. Don't you think that someone would have given these people a call and said, hey, what's going on? What's your evacuation plan? How can we help? It's mind-boggling to think how this thing gets amplified in the damn echo chamber of this of right-wing talk radio, Fox News. It's banging around in these people's heads, and it's coming out all over the Internet. It's coming out of these empty heads, and we have to do something about it. September 24th is one way to do it. I hope people could think of other more creative ways, but that's all I got for you now.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bennett. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. September 24th, show up in Washington, D.C. Good suggestion. Good on you, Bennett. Rick in Grand Rapids, what's up?
Well, Tom, good day to you. I was wondering what you thought about how the gas prices would be affected by this. Of course, they had been going up, and now, of course, they've got a they got another excuse. Now, I was watching Bill O'Reilly, who's usually no friend of progressives, but he's coming quite down, quite hard on the oil companies. He says they should devote 20% of their profits to helping out. Of course, that'll never happen.
You know why? You know why he would say something like that that completely contradicts his own philosophy? Is because he's getting it. That if these guys don't put some patina on this thing, put a coat of paint on their philosophy, so it's not entirely obvious, that they're going to start losing even more listeners and viewers.
Well, the other thing is, he had a woman on from Forbes magazine, which I don't believe is a liberal publication, and this woman said that although she does believe in the free enterprise system, she says what the oil companies are doing is not free enterprise, it's gouging. Now, they had another guy on who was a complete apologist for the businesses, saying, you know, a businessman has a right to make a profit. And, of course, O'Reilly says, well, even in times of tragedy. And I'm just wondering whether people like O'Reilly and this lady, I forget her name now, and apparently even some Republicans were saying that this whole disaster response team, whatever you want to call them, FEMA, you know, they just were totally inadequate.
These guys are all gung-ho. Thanks, Rick, for the call. These guys are all gung-ho in favor of making a profit in the tragedy of Iraq, because we don't see the pictures of the bodies in Iraq. We don't see the 100,000 dead civilians. The Pentagon won't let us see it. The Pentagon won't count the numbers. You gotta let the European Union do that. The Pentagon won't, you know, the president won't let us see the caskets of our soldiers coming back. They don't like us seeing the wounded and the injured coming back. So, you know, no problem in O'Reilly's world with making a profit on that. You know, during World War II, Senator Harry Truman, Democratic Senator Harry Truman, convened a commission in Congress during World War II to investigate corruption in the Franklin Roosevelt administration in the awarding of military contracts. And how did Roosevelt respond to that? He made Truman his vice president. Can you imagine a Republic, anybody in the Bush administration saying, oh, yeah, sure, investigate us. We really need to look into this stuff. I mean, we need to get to the bottom of this. Yeah, sure, Congress, you do that. See, Democrats controlled the House, Democrats controlled the Senate, Democrats controlled the White House, and the Democrat, Harry Truman, decided that he was going to investigate what was going on in the Roosevelt administration and see if there was war profiteering going on. And Roosevelt said, I tip my hat to you. We will cooperate fully. Roosevelt said, I don't want there to be a single millionaire made on this war. And he meant it. Well, now we have today's news. This from oriadaily.blogspot.com. News report, President Bush this morning promised to lead an investigation of himself because it is important. Bush hopes to find out why Bush flew quickly to San Diego in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and why, while there, Bush attempted to play the guitar. Bush also hopes to find out why Bush cut funds to levee rehabilitation in Louisiana. Further, Bush hopes to discover the reason Bush appointed a horse association boss to run FEMA and why Bush cut funds to the organization as well. Bush will investigate the reasons for Bush's high praise of the Department of Homeland Security's and FEMA's response to the catastrophe on the Gulf Coast while thousands were left to fend for themselves for days on end. Bush wants to know what Bush was doing at a retirement community on August 29th and why Bush was holding a birthday cake for John McCain that day as well. Bush wants to figure out why Bush never realized a Category 4 storm could flood New Orleans when everyone else in the country knew. Bush is going to look into the reasons why Bush has refused to take seriously the loss of marshlands along the Louisiana coast and why Bush thinks global warming is a sham. Bush also wants to know how all those National Guardsmen and women got to Iraq when they're supposed to be here. Bush wants to know why Bush supports Judge Michael Chertoff and exactly why Bush appointed him head of Homeland Security to begin with. Bush will also investigate why Bush never knew that there were poor people around anyway. Bush also intends to find out once and for all just what Bush is always smiling about. Finally, Bush wants to discover just why the front porch of Senator Trent Lott's home was allowed to be destroyed. In other words, the Bush committee is going to get to the bottom of Bush's bottom. That's great. Good on you. O-R-E-A-D, daily.blogspot.com. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Virginia and Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Hey, Virginia.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better.
I absolutely love your show.
Thank you.
But I was just listening to the local news here.
Uh-huh.
And I smell a rat because they were just saying that no evacuees are coming to Massachusetts. I actually live on Cape Cod.
Yeah. They were supposed to be coming here to Oregon, and today the governor was notified that they are not going to send them. We've already prepared for them. I smell a rat, too. I think it's,
we have 2,500 beds available.
I know. And guess what? In all of the centers now, they're in there recruiting for the military. So I think that maybe they're figuring that they can. Yeah, they're holding a job fair right now in the Astrodome in Houston. They're recruiting all those people in there. Anybody who's of military age, they're trying to recruit them to send them off to Iraq. So, you know, surprise, surprise, they won't need as many beds if they can get them into the Army.
Do you have any idea where I can go to get to the bottom of this?
I just don't know, Virginia. I mean, there's so much. Check out BuzzFlash.com.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds.
You tell him, Tracy, a revolution at the ballot box.
Standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Gary in Emporia, Kansas. Hey, Gary.
Tom, I think I may have figured out why they cut the communication line.
FEMA did in Jefferson Parish, why?
Yep, so they could control the communications. That way they could sanitize this thing where people wouldn't see the bodies, they wouldn't see the destruction, they could see the photo ops that were being set up. They could have control of the communication. These people are heartless. They just are absolutely heartless.
Well, you know, on the one hand, Gary, I got to say, it's hard to believe that they would do that in the United States. On the other hand, that's exactly what they've been doing in Iraq for 2 years.
It's not hard to believe. It's now becoming obvious. You're right. This is what they've been doing in Iraq, and this is why people don't recognize, because they are controlling the thing. They don't see the body bags coming back. They don't see the people floating in the mud and in the flood down there. They don't see that, but they see the photo ops that are set up by these heartless bastards. Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm so angry, I just can't. I can't see straight right now.
I understand, Gary, and I appreciate the call. I'm going to move along. I'll let you get yourself together there. Ryan in Flagstaff, Arizona, what's up?
Hi. I am a mother of two, a stay-at-home mom, and we don't have TV or anything, so I haven't seen any of this stuff on television, but I've been listening to the radio a lot, and I'm just disgusted.
Yeah.
And I don't really know why I called, but I just wanted to wonder when this country's going to wake up and realize what's happening.
I have a feeling, Ryan, that there is a massive awakening happening right now.
I hope so, because, you know, I have a friend here in town who, you know, is so against this administration, cannot believe his eyes, can't even stand in the room with somebody that may have voted for Bush or not, and I stand with him.
Yeah, and what we need to do is we need to be getting out there and getting politically active. Join your local Democratic Party. Join the local Green Party. Show up at, go to the website, democracyforamerica.com, and sign up for one of their meetups. I mean, there's a lot of great groups around there. Ryan,
yeah. Oh, you have
Ryan,
to
I got, yeah, I got to wrap it up here. It's the end of the hour, but thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you.
Hey, thanks for letting me on.
You're welcome. I appreciate your calling. This is the time. You know, Bush is out there saying, "Well, let's not politicize this. Let's not play blame." You know, as they're trying to blame the mayor and the governor, right? Aggressively. This is the time to get political, because politics is how we help ourselves.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. He's the man who uncovered uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, live 365, whiterosesociety.org, podcast at Apple's iTunes. Well, welcome back to our program. Our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. Brandy in Coos Bay, Oregon. You have some thoughts on the issues of the day. Hey, Brandy.
Hi, how's it going, Tom?
I am great. What's up?
Oh, it's great to talk to you. I love your show.
Thank you.
I just want to say that, like, right now, I'm having a peace rally down in Coos Bay on September 11th. I'm a single mom with two jobs. We need to get together right now and speak out against this administration, against Bush, about what's going on. People need to get together, do whatever they can, get people together, get our voices out there and get heard.
I agree. I don't know what I can say beyond. I agree.
I mean, it might seem something small, but, you know, anything, just people getting together right now, being heard.
Right.
One voice is weak, but many are strong.
So, Brandy, the folks who are listening on KBBR there in Coos Bay, what would you like them to do?
On September 11th, 12 noon at Sunset Beach, we're meeting. We're having an open mic forum. I would just love anybody who has anything to say to come on out, get together, speak out against this administration, against the war.
Okay.
Let our voices be heard.
And come to where again?
Sunset Beach. It's in Coos Bay, Oregon, 12 noon.
Got it. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Good on you. Bob in Colorado Springs. Hey, Bob. What's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? The thing that bothers me about this, I mean, granted, the federal level failed massively. Okay, I mean, that's a given. But there was also failure at the state and local levels. It's like the Republican administration gets castigated for failure, but the Democratic administration...
What was the failure at the state and local level?
Prior to the evacuation, prior to the hurricane hitting, we knew this thing was coming. Have you seen the photographs of the school bus parking lot from New Orleans School District, for example?
I have. Do you know how many people those school buses could have carried if he could have gotten the drivers of those school buses to abandon their families and come drive school buses?
Still would have been more than was left.
It would have been 10,000 people.
It would have been a substantial number.
You still would have had 90,000 people left in the city. That was not the solution. The solution was that FEMA has, as part of their action plan, this is what Larry Johnson was talking about in the previous hour, the former CIA officer, that FEMA has as part of their action plan to get in there and evacuate people. They did it in Florida. They did it with every hurricane in Florida. They had it all set. They were pre-positioned. They had food in place. They had water in place. They didn't do it in Louisiana. Why? Good question. It's not a red state. Jeb Bush isn't the governor, who's the crony and brother of George W. Bush. It's not the month before an election like it was with Hurricanes Charlie and Francis in Florida. But you want to lay the blame on Ray Nagin. Nagin did everything he could. He notified the White House. The White House knew about this. FEMA knew about this. Governor Kathleen Blanco, the governor of the state, the day before the hurricane hit, she declared a state of emergency, and she requested in writing that Bush declare a state of emergency. He declared a state of emergency the next day. That was Saturday. The current hurricane hits Saturday night and Sunday, and Bush does nothing. The reason why you have federal agencies, Bob, is because there are some things that are too big for a city that's been wiped out to deal with.
Granted. But now we're into this thing. What is it? What's today? Wednesday? And Nagin is only just now issuing mandatory evacuation orders.
No, I'm sorry. That's a lie. And I don't know where you got that from, but Nagin ordered a mandatory evacuation order on the day of the hurricane, the day before the hurricane struck. As soon as it became apparent that that hurricane was going to strike, get out of town. It was absolutely there.
I got it from CNN. I mean, he's... Only today they're saying get out or you're going to be put out. It's just
I see where the police go door to door. You're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, and again, that's a huge effort.
No,
but
you know, so he didn't. I don't think that anybody. I mean, a mandatory evacuation order where you're going to ask the police department to spend all their time going door to door and rousting people out is just not practical when you've got a hurricane coming in 10 hours. You tell people get out of town and you provide the Superdome, and you say, and if you can't get out of town, here's where you can go that'll be safe. That's what he did.
Okay. It's just there's plenty of blame to go around all the way, all parties.
I'm sorry. I'm not seeing it. And this is not partisan on my part. If Ray Nagin had been a Republican, I'm not seeing it. If the governor of Louisiana had been a Republican, I'm not seeing it. Because the governor of Louisiana notified FEMA and George W. Bush and asked for federal disaster help even before the hurricane hit. Yes, I know the Washington Post quoted a senior administration official saying she didn't ask for it until several days after the hurricane hit. It was a lie. Karl Rove leaked that to the Washington Post. It was a lie. Her letter is online. Go see. Go to buzzflash.com and see the actual letter.
It was declared a disaster area before the hurricane even hit, though. I mean, the whole Gulf Coast was declared a disaster area.
It was declared emergency area.
Whatever. And
that's the point. And FEMA did nothing. On Saturday, she declares it a disaster area. On Friday, she declares it a disaster area, an emergency area. On Saturday, Bush declares a state of emergency. On Sunday, they're supposed to show up. On Monday, Brown writes a letter to Chertoff saying, we ought to do something because our image is going to be harmed if we don't. And on Tuesday, nothing happens. On Wednesday, nothing happens. Finally, Chertoff says, okay, let's go do something.
Yeah.
Now, you tell me that's the fault of Ray Nagin. I'm sorry, Bob. I'm not buying it.
Okay.
But I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. It is, hang on just a second here. Jay in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, more to that point you were just making, like, you know, that guy, Aaron Broussard, his comments and similar comments. And I heard Randy Rhodes say yesterday that Al Gore himself, out of his own pocket, hired two planes and got a friend of his who was a doctor. They were told to turn around.
I heard Al Gore say that last night. I went to hear him speak here in Portland, Oregon.
So, to me, it seems like the equivalent of how 9/11 was an inside job, and they deliberately allow these people to suffer. And how can they possibly not be held accountable for deliberately sabotaging rescue efforts? How do they get away with that?
You know, Jay, I got to say, I don't think 9/11 was an inside job, and I don't think this was an inside job. I think both of them demonstrate. I'm not defending them. I think that both of these demonstrate the massive incompetence of these people because they don't believe in government. If you don't believe in government, you can't govern. And that's why George Bush got 56 specific warnings that 9/11 was going to happen. And what did he do? He goes on vacation. And then when the strike doesn't happen, when his vacation is over, he goes to Florida. He's unwilling to go back to Washington, D.C. They know something terrible is going to happen. They don't know what. They don't know where. They know something terrible is going to happen.
Well, I think it was you yesterday that you read the FEMA rules, and it said that part of the relief is expected or allowed to come from the private sector. So why the hell can they justify Al Gore being turned away and the Coast Guard being denied?
Al Gore wasn't turned away. He was actually able to get in there.
Oh, interesting. Well, nonetheless,
evacuated people.
But if Aaron Broussard is telling them that the Coast Guard cut their communication lines and turned down fuel
and Walmart. No, FEMA cut their communications. The Coast Guard tried to give them fuel, and FEMA turned them away, too. And I think, I agree with Larry Johnson. In all probability, what that's all about is not, FEMA trying to destroy New Orleans. I really don't think these guys are about destroying New Orleans. I think their incompetence is destroying New Orleans. I think what it was about was FEMA trying to say, okay, we're in charge of the control. We're taking control of this thing. All these guys know. This is the thing you have to understand, Jay. They don't understand government in a protective capacity. They only know government in a punishing capacity. That's all cons can understand is punish. It's that critical father thing. They don't get it about the nurturing mother part of government. That the tribe of us. That one of the reasons we create government is so that we can help each other. And because they don't get that, they can't function in that world. They're just it's beyond their capability.
Maybe my point's more complicated than that. But the fact that Michael Brown has no experience other than being that roommate of what's his name, that alone is like, okay, everybody needs to have their heads rolled, including Bush. How do you defend that? Not that you are, but
yeah, no, absolutely. I mean that's just the beginning of it. And Jay, thanks for the call. I mean, so you get rid of Michael Brown. Okay, let's fire him. Right? He was the roommate of the guy who is now the lobbyist for Halliburton, the former head of FEMA, Joe Albaugh, was Bush's campaign manager. Bush awards him. He has no experience in emergency management. Bush awards him by making him head of FEMA. Then Albaugh leaves FEMA after 2 years, puts his former college roommate, Michael Brown, in charge, who had been running the Arabian Horse Association, and Albaugh is off now lobbying for Halliburton, which just got a contract for reconstruction after Hurricane Katrina, by coincidence. But if you get rid of Brown, his number two guy, his chief of staff, Patrick Rode, what did he do before this? He planned events for President Bush's political campaigns. He has no emergency management experience. And what if you fire him? Let's drill three, four levels down. The deputy chief of staff, the number three guy at FEMA, Scott Morris. He was a press flack for President Bush's political campaign. Previously, he worked for a company that produced Bush campaign commercials. He also has no emergency management experience. This is beyond the pale, as they say. Dr. Christian Weller is with us. He's a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. Hey, Dr. Weller.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good. We got a lot of folks who just want to ventilate on this thing. And Katrina's victims are not the only victims of the Bush administration and conservative economic policies and just policies in general here in the United States. You have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, we got the new numbers from the Census Bureau last week on poverty, health insurance coverage, and incomes. And let me just say, like, what that report showed is, like, for 5 years running, we didn't see the incomes of the typical family rise. That's the longest period we have had. We've seen poverty, the number of people in poverty go up. We have seen the number of people without health insurance go up by 1.1 million. And then you got to put this in perspective and then see this as a backdrop to what's happening in New Orleans, where hundreds of thousands of poor people have lost their jobs, losing their homes, losing their livelihoods. So they're being hurt on top of a very weak labor market over the last few years. So this is a double whammy. And it's important that what this report clearly showed is an indictment of the failure of the economic policies of this administration to translate economic growth into rising living standards.
Now, yesterday on his program, Rush Limbaugh was saying that this demonstrated the failure of the welfare state, as if to imply that if you're black, you must be unemployed and on welfare. In fact, the vast majority of African Americans in New Orleans were actually employed and had jobs. They just didn't have jobs that paid enough money that they could afford to have their SUV topped off when the hurricane warning came.
Right. I mean, like, when disaster strikes, and be it that a hurricane or massive plant closures in an industrial town, the poor will always be the most hurt, or the middle class folks will always be the most hurt, because what is happening is people who don't have any savings accounts because they're heavily indebted can't just simply pick up and leave, because moving somewhere else, requires having a car that you could fill up, but also it requires more money to then pay for a motel, to buy for food on the road, and to start your life over again. So the most vulnerable will always be the ones worst hurt. And on top of that, we've been cutting back on the programs that would help people, such as unemployment.
Well, we're doing that because these cons don't believe in those programs. They think that all that stuff should be handled by either private charity or private commerce, private industry.
Well, I find it always ironic that in the middle of these disasters, then there's the call for big government to step in and help out. And
well, sort of. You know, today, the Tom DeLay just said that this, more than ever now, we need to privatize Social Security, because that money, that Social Security money that the government's sitting on, is going to be needed for Hurricane Katrina victims. So.
Yeah, that kind of is a very weird,
absolutely bizarre
argument.
Christian Weller, where can people find more about your study? We've got to wrap this up. I'm sorry.
This is a census report. It can be at census.org, and you can find us at AmericanProgress.org.
www.AmericanProgress.org. Dr. Christian Weller, the senior economist at the Center for American Progress. Great study. Great work you guys are doing there. I am just so pleased and so impressed. We use so much of your information. Thank you so much for being with us today.
You.
Keep up the great work. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity. That's the reason why...
And welcome back, my friends. This is just in. Not from the American press, no, from the Australian. A national newspaper in Australia, the U.S. government agency leading the rescue efforts after Hurricane Katrina, does not want the news media to take photographs of the dead as they are recovered from the flooded New Orleans area. FEMA trying to crack down on the press. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, heavily criticized for its slow response, rejected requests from journalists to accompany rescue boats. Agency spokesman says, no, we're going to treat these victims with utmost dignity and respect. You can't take pictures of them. Amazing. Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service. What do you think, Ellen?
Well,
are they going to be able to cover it up?
I was just talking off the record to a Republican senator who I will not mention his name, but I have to tell you, this guy is totally and completely distressed, and this is one of the more, I would say, concerned senators on the Republican Party at FEMA's response, because all over what is happening is people on Capitol Hill, particularly Democrats, but also Republicans, are getting not only stories of FEMA doing things like you can't sit, take photographs, but are preventing convoys from getting in, convoys from getting out, preventing people to be replaced in places. This is the kind of thing we're seeing. It's just bureaucratic messes on every single level.
And, well, it goes beyond bureaucratic. I mean, this, because bureaucratic is a word that Republicans love to use to beat up on any kind of government program in the hopes that they can replace it with a corporate program, which ultimately will also have bureaucrats. They exist in both worlds. This is just absolute incompetence from the top down. You've got 1,000 firefighters.
Well, you've got, that's why, I mean, I use the word bureaucrats, maybe I shouldn't, but you've got people on every level of FEMA who are fiefdom people who aren't able, they're protecting their little areas, they are not able to think largely, they're not able to think about how to get people out,
But that isn't a bureaucratic failure, that's a leadership failure, Ellen.
Well, yes, it is a leadership failure, but even if you, I mean, I know enough about Washington Town that even if you're at the top of an organization, sometimes, and an organization is huge, you cannot see to the bottom of it, and that's a big problem. The other problem is, of course, and there's lots of talk on Capitol Hill. I'm just returning from a morning on the Hill where this came up yesterday, it's coming up again today, whether FEMA should not be taken out of Homeland Security, and I also heard something else, which we're checking out. I'm not sure this is true. I heard that the head of Homeland Security, Chertoff, does not even own a BlackBerry. Or, like,
you mean like there's no way to get in touch with him?
Well, like, if you're on a phone service, if you want to get him email, and he's on the road, it's very difficult to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, you know, everyone, my friend, actually two people, Steny Hoyer, the Democrat, and Republican Bob Ney, bought BlackBerries for the 435 members of the House. I mean, they just did it. They didn't ask their permission 2 years ago. They just bought them so that they could communicate. And you have to wonder if what I'm hearing happens to be true, and we're going to check this out with FEMA, it's beyond.
Yeah. You have 1,000 firefighters from all over the United States who volunteered to go down and help. They said to FEMA, we're ready. Most of them showed up with their uniforms and their tanks and their masks and their axes and whatever. And they showed up, and FEMA put them in a hotel, in a Sheraton hotel in Atlanta, Georgia, where they've been cooling their heels now for up to a week. And they're being trained in sexual harassment classes. So when they pass out the flyers talking about the good work FEMA is doing, which they're discovering that's the job they're going to be allowed to do, they will not hit on people inappropriately. And several of these, this Salt Lake Tribune reporting this, several of these firefighters are now saying that's it. They're taking off the FEMA-issued T-shirts that say FEMA on them and saying, I'm having nothing to do with this. However, 50 of them were pulled out of this group in Atlanta and sent down to Louisiana on Monday, complete with all the regalia. Why? To stand in a photo opportunity with President Bush.
This is
beyond just bureaucratic incompetence, Ellen.
They're not even calling for an investigation on the Hill.
Yeah.
They're trying to use a different word just to figure out what happens. They don't want the word investigation used.
Well, you know, George Bush says he's going to lead an investigation of himself. It's vitally important. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Always great to hear from you, Ellen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye now. Yes, Bush hopes to find out why Bush failed to have any kind of competent response in the Bush administration.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a million sad stories on the side of the road. Strange how we all just got used to the blood. Millions of stories that'll never be told. Silent and frozen in the mud.
And they'll definitely not be told now that FEMA has said no more pictures of dead bodies. Sorry, press out, get out. We've got a mandatory evacuation order, so no reporters can be in this city. The military is taking over. They're controlling communications. And they are telling the press, sorry, you may not take pictures. At the same time that they are aggressively trying to change the spin, change the whole thing as fast and as well as they can. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Mike in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I want to talk about Michael Brown, famous director. His old boss, the former director, Albaugh.
Yeah.
Joe Albaugh used to be the FEMA head, says, Michael Brown learned the system. He's my logical successor, and he's doing a great job. It's, you know, Bush's doing a heck of a job. And,
right.
Well, I heard on another radio show last night, the guy had to take, like, had to have 130 emergencies under his belt before he could take the reins, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he completed that, but in a kind of backhanded way, like maybe like four or five emergencies. It would count as four or five emergencies in one blizzard because the blizzard maybe crossed state lines into five different states, so they could count it as...
You're kidding.
No. And not only that, one of them was a guy got his leg trapped between a boulder and a fallen tree.
Mm-hmm.
That was his emergency number 58 or whatever.
I'm all in favor, Mike, of on-the-job training. I think it's a great way for people to learn a job. But when you're talking about running the disaster agency for the entire United States of America, I'd mm-hmm. rather really not have the top three people in that agency be former campaign flacks for the president.
Yeah.
I'd rather have them have some experience in emergencies.
Yeah. Another thing, Bush said, well, there's no way we could have possibly have imagined, just like 9/11, there's no way we could have possibly imagined planes flying into buildings.
Yeah.
Or there's no way we could imagine New Orleans, being the levees being overrun like this. Oh, no. There's I don't know if you've talked about it yet, but there was a 2004 ad by the folks who did the old Saturday Night Live character, Mr. Bill.
Yeah.
And here I got like a 15-second clip of it.
It looks like Hurricane Sluggo is headed right for us here in the mountains wetlands.
That's right, and since New Orleans is below sea level, if a hurricane hit us directly, it could push the water over the levee and fill it to the top. Let's act now before it's too late.
That was like a year and a half ago.
Well, they weren't watching the cartoons. Mike,
well, it's a TV ad being put on in Louisiana.
Oh, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mike, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing that. I appreciate it. Alice in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Alice.
Yeah, good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
You think it was accident that they turned away truckloads of clean water? Was it an accident that they sent away a hospital ship?
No, I don't think it was an accident.
So many sick and injured.
No.
I believe they can be very vindictive, and they believe these people vote Democrat, and I too
these
believe...
people being the residents of New Orleans.
Pardon?
The people you're referring to who vote Democratic are the people in New Orleans, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I too believe that it was an inside job.
Okay. Well, Alice, you've had 91 years to observe the scene, and I have great respect for your observations. Thank you for sharing them with us.
Okay.
It's always great to hear from you. David in Michigan on the line. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, well, not to sidetrack you from the quagmire that has potentially killed three times more citizens than Al-Qaeda did on 911.
Yes, sir.
What was the
and maybe more than that.
Oh. what's the latest news on Karl Rove leaking that information about the CIA agent's name?
The grand jury dissolves at the end of this month. And so presumably there are actually I'm not sure if the grand jury itself dissolves, but the guy who's Patrick Fitzgerald, the guy who's leading the investigation, he loses his job at the end of this month. And so presumably by the end of this month, there will be something, either they will choose to indict Rove or Rove and Cheney or Rove and Libby and, who knows, or they will just go away. And, of course, the Republicans are hoping that they'll just go away.
Yeah, well, given the fact that he's going to have to pretty much babysit the Republican Party till the end of time now, I think they're going to try to keep him around as much as they can.
Oh, that they have been all this time. I mean, it was an open secret in Washington, D.C. that Karl Rove was the guy who outed the CIA agent. It wasn't, everybody knew it in Washington, D.C. They just weren't talking about it to we the people. And so, I mean, you had Joe Wilson going around saying, this is pretty obvious that this is the guy. In fact, Joe Wilson... on this program, in other venues, and here's Joe Wilson early on.
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
Yeah, I mean, that's Joe Wilson. That was 2 years ago, almost, you know, a year and a half ago, something like that. And, yeah, so, and Bush is like, well, we don't have any idea. Anyhow, David, thanks for the call.
All right, you take it easy.
You too. Good to hear from you. This is truly a disaster of epic proportions. Speaking of disasters of epic proportions, the Bush labor policies are worthy of our scrutiny. Alec DeBrow is with us from the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA Online. Hey, Alec.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am well. How are you on this fine day, and what's on your mind today?
It is a beautiful day in Washington, which is, of course, deceptive every time it happens these days. But nevertheless, there it is. And, see, you know, to talk about labor at this point in view of the disaster on the Gulf Coast seems like almost trivial.
Well,
let me provide
a frame for it, Alec.
Okay.
Most, contrary to what Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh and all these other cons are running around spouting out, the majority of the African Americans in New Orleans were not on welfare. They were employed.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the heads of households were employed. They were not, however, employed in jobs where they had union representation. And therefore, they did not have a good enough paycheck that they could buy a car. They did not have a good enough paycheck that they could get themselves out of town or themselves and their families. They did not have a good enough paycheck that they could move to a fancier part of town that might be a little higher and drier. They were stuck. And in part, you got Limbaugh saying, well, this proves the failure of the welfare state. In my opinion, it proves the failure of 25 years of conservative economic policies that have put the absolute screws to the middle class and have wiped out the props that have been used, the support structure that has been used ever since LBJ, basically, ever since the War on Poverty and the Great Society, that has been used to allow people who have suffered 300 years in this country of discrimination and slavery to allow them to move into the middle class. I mean, there's this huge movement of African Americans after the civil rights laws were passed from 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education through the 1960s and the War on Poverty and the Great Society. There was this huge movement of African Americans in the late 60s and the 70s and in the early 80s from poverty into the black middle class. It became huge. Largely as a consequence of things like the ability to get grants to go to college, the affirmative action programs. It's like, you know, giving people an opportunity to step into the middle class, and then they'll bring their family with them. Then the next generation will you know, move forward and move ahead. And those props have been ripped out by these cons who don't believe in this stuff. They say, oh, no, it should simply be every man for himself. I mean, you had Rehnquist out there harassing African-American voters in Arizona before he was made Supreme Court justice and saying that Plessy versus Ferguson, the 1896 case that established segregation in the United States, should be affirmed, you know, should be kept. Anyhow, these cons don't believe in these programs, and they have fought them tooth and nail. And as a result, ever since Reagan, we've seen the erosion of those programs that allow the black poor class to move into the black middle class or into the general middle class. And thus, the failure in New Orleans, in my opinion, is not the failure of the welfare state, as Limbaugh said. It is the failure of 25 years of conservative economic policies that have thrown people in poverty back into the original situation they were in without any opportunity to get out.
I couldn't agree more. However, I'd like to throw something else into the mix here, which is the Republican Party's deft playing of the race card. And, you know, it doesn't exempt the fact that this takes place at leadership level doesn't exempt the people who go along with it. I was just looking up the state of Louisiana, which has a long and sorry record in race relations. Within, let's not even call it living memory, within a fairly short time ago, 65% of the white people voted for David Duke, the white supremacist leader, when he challenged J. Bennett Johnston for the Democratic senatorial seat.
65%?
That's the estimate. I mean, low estimate was 55. But certainly a majority of white people voted. They crossed party lines in this case because it was an open primary and flooded in and did so. Now, the way that this is played, in part, is that Republicans at this point, which are the dominant white supremacist party, managed to garner these votes based on race. And at the same time, as you point out so clearly, they used this promising, I don't know what they're promising in terms of racial purity, but at the same time, they managed to decimate every program that would benefit even poor white people. And
the other thing that Americans so quickly forget, particularly with all the demagoguery on the right, is that there are more poor white people in the United States than there are poor black people. And, you know, they want to portray it as if a person is African American, they must be on welfare and they must be poor and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it is a lie. It is a lie. There's a huge black middle class and there's a large white poor class.
That's absolutely
pardon,
true.
Pardon my interrupting your rant there, but.
No, it's absolutely true. And I wouldn't seek to represent it otherwise. That, however, was not the case in New Orleans, nor is it the case in most major cities. Yeah. Cities being far more visible to the media than rural areas, it appears as though black people constitute poor people and do so on the basis of race, when in fact they just happen to be occupying this position of poverty.
Yeah, you're right. Most white poverty is rural poverty.
It is rural poverty.
I saw it
up
close and personal in Vermont. Yeah.
Right. And people don't necessarily identify themselves as poor people. They may identify themselves as something else. But it's very interesting. The black workers, and let's call them workers in New Orleans, because most of them work. And even those who are on welfare and are not working, most of their lives they work. There are periods of their lives when they're not working. But, of course, that's also true of middle-class people. They just don't have to go on welfare.
Or at least they didn't used to have to.
No, they didn't used to have to.
Increasingly now, you've got a middle class that's being eviscerated.
Well, when I was a bum, I called it going to school, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are ways around it. But you're absolutely right. There are longer and longer periods for more and more people at this point. But most, as I understand it, much of the black working class in New Orleans worked the invisible, low-paid jobs in the tourist industry. And, you know, they whatever wealth New Orleans had derived from this visible and sometimes notorious industry was done on the backs of these people, who, as you point out, were largely, if not exclusively, not unionized, were not being paid a living wage, and were vulnerable to any kind of any kind of harm, but in this case, you know, the almost ultimate disaster.
Alec, do you see organized labor? I mean, we're talking with Alec Dubrow. He's the director of media communications for the
ILC,
International Labor Communications Association. Pardon me.
Yes, sir.
Something else just flashed on my screen there and grabbed my mind. The International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org. Alec, do you see any sort of an opportunity here in this situation for it's not even an opportunity. I mean, what do you see organized labor stepping up to the plate in any way with regard to what's happened in New Orleans? I mean, are there any movements by organized labor to help out with relief and things like that?
Oh, yes, like any other organized group, you know, I get messages flashed across my screen constantly. The AFL-CIO specifically is organizing 1,000 people to go down and work with, you know, through existing labor organizations, which hopefully that doesn't mean just white people, but to give relief. And whether it's an opportunity or a disaster, you know, that old one about the Chinese sign for in the I Ching, that opportunity and danger are the same sign.
Right.
Well, we shall see. I mean, I can't make a prediction here. It's interesting, though, that southern Louisiana, like parts of Alabama, were in fact the most unionized parts of the South, in large part and for the longest time because of the oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
What was formerly the oil, chemical, and atomic workers, which became PACE and are now part of the steel workers, had a very strong base.
How do you respond, Alec, to the folks who say, that's all very well and good what you're saying about organized labor, but organized labor has had a history of locking out minorities, particularly African Americans in the United States, and that history continues to this day?
Well, the truth of the matter is that racism inflects everything we do. There is no reason why it wouldn't.
We as human beings, we as Americans, or we, or you
well,
guys as organized labor?
Well, let's make it more specific. White supremacy inflects everything that Americans have to do. Not every American all the time. It doesn't mean everybody acts in a white supremacist fashion.
By Americans, you're referring to white Americans, you mean?
Yes, I am.
Okay. There's African Americans are Americans as well, black Americans.
That's true. And they, of course, well, let's not go off in that direction.
Yeah. No, in fact,
but the truth of the matter is, where there was power, white supremacy was also part
power
of it.
Language.
And it was most certainly true among unions, some of whom were avowedly white well into the 60s and 70s. But
is that changing?
It has changed.
It has changed.
The most racist ones are now substantially people of color.
Great.
And it continues apace.
Okay, great. Alec DeBrow, media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org. Alec, thanks again for being with us today.
Okay, Tom.
Good
talk to you next
media.
Week.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
It's 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 55 minutes past the hour, 55 and a half. Tom Hartman here with you. Agency blocks photos of flood dead. This is just the most amazing thing. The Australian. Let's see if we see this reported in the American press. The U.S. government agency leading the rescue efforts after Hurricane Katrina does not want the news media to take photographs of the dead as they recovered from the flooded New Orleans area. Spokeswoman for FEMA, we have requested that no photographs of the deceased be made by the media. Can't even take the picture. The Australian also notes the Bush administration has also prevented the news media from photographing flag-draped caskets of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq, which has sparked criticism that the government is trying to block images that put the war in a bad light. Mm-hmm. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number, Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Thank you very much. Tom, about the Salvation Army and about the legal genocide of the American middle class by Ronnie Reagan. It started in 1984.
Started in 1980.
Was it 80?
Yeah.
By the way, the lawyer's name was Poli, P-O-L-I, and he just urged the union to go on strike, and then he resigned.
Are you talking about the PATCO?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Huh. Airline
professional air traffic whatever controllers organization. Yeah,
and that was a setup. That was a total setup. Ronnie Reagan declared war on the middle class, and he destroyed us. It's been going on ever since.
Sure.
Now, by the way, Tom, Exxon, Occidental, Chevron, Conoco has so far. Those are the biggest profiteers right now. I managed to get those names. The oil companies that have profited have really been gouging.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're making, in the last quarter, they were making billions, tens of billions of dollars in aggregate. And, you know, every quarter has to be better than the last quarter if you want to make your bonus.
So
there's an opportunity. I mean, why is it here I am in Portland, Oregon. Our oil is not coming through the Port of Louisiana, but our gas prices just went through the roof.
This question for you, Tom, and listen, I think the world of you. And I'll tell you why, because you keep it straight and honest. Why was my favorite charity is Salvation Army. I've had nightmares when I was in the service with the Red Cross.
Yeah, Will, I'm sorry, we're out of time. I appreciate your calling and appreciate your comments, but just, you know, the clock, the tyranny of the clock. So we'll have to catch that that next week, because I'm sorry. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Hillary Clinton standing. This is incredible. You cannot convince me they are not manipulating this market, she told an audience in New York, New York, pointing out that ExxonMobil Corporation in the last quarter made $7.64 billion in profits. She said, if we don't fight big oil, this country's going down. Interesting. Somebody stood up and said, well, why don't we, if we want to lower oil, to lower the cost of gasoline, why don't we reduce the tax on gasoline? And she said, that's not going to do that. We're not going to do that. And in fact, reducing the tax on gasoline, what, you're not going to stop building roads? People don't understand that taxes are there for a purpose, to do something. Barry Lynn is with us. Hey, Barry.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me today.
You're welcome. Barry is the author of The End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation. Barry, nice title. Barry is a fellow at the New American Foundation in Washington, D.C. And is there a website for this, Barry?
Well, newamerica.net will lead you into information about the book and links to places where you can buy the book.
Okay. newamerica.net. But as you know, as I look through it, it seems to me that basically what you're saying is that rather than being dependent upon one particular nation like India or China for our cheap labor, that we should spread our dependence around a large number of cheap labor nations.
Well, I mean, my idea is that, I mean, what we need to do is think about our global industrial system in an entirely new way. I mean, what we've done is we have created this, or we've allowed these private sector entities to create this system without really thinking about what would make it safe. And by safe, I mean in terms of what is necessary for our national security to make sure that we're not become overly dependent on one other nation for key sources of our product.
So how are you going to solve the problem that right now we can't manufacture a missile, we can't manufacture a destroyer without buying parts from a half a dozen other countries, principally China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, but other countries as well. We can't do it. We just can't do it. We have lost that manufacturing capacity here.
We did.
We,
you're absolutely right. We actually, in say the case of like complex systems like a missile, complex systems like a destroyer, we actually gave away, lost that ability a long time ago. I think it was at the end of the Vietnam War, they realized that, actually the United States was reliant for certain technologies on the Europeans and the Japanese. But the thing is the issue is if you're reliant on countries that are your friends and you actually have some access to the technology itself and you can replicate it if necessary, that's not necessarily a problem. The problem is when you become overly reliant on one place for the things that you need the basic things you need for life.
But friends change. I mean, if in 1790, France was our friend. They had financed the American Revolution. By 1797, John Adams was beating the war drums against France. Iraq, Saddam Hussein was our friend. He was going to sell us all kinds of oil. In fact, he was. We put him into power. We supported him. We helped him in the war against Iran. All of a sudden, he wasn't our friend. Friends change. And isn't there a larger issue here of what about the jobs?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of our friends, generally what we found is that liberal democracies, countries that are liberal democracies, tend to work together very, very well. And then when there's tensions, they're able to work out the problems in an open and a democratic way. And everyone, there's never, ever been major problems between liberal democracies.
Wouldn't you agree, though, that Germany was a liberal democracy in 1925?
Germany was the Weimar was a I don't know if anyone can really call it a functioning democracy.
Well, it was a republic. I mean, they were saddled with enormous debt from the Treaty of Versailles, you know, which a lot of certainly the Germans will argue was what you know caused them to have to make decisions, and they would say have to make decisions that destroyed their currency and led to the rise of Hitler. But you know, they had a functioning democracy.
No, I agree, and I actually think that one of the things that even if you need to have your reliance, you need to have where you're buying from so spread out so that even if a liberal democracy has a problem, even if it starts to drift in the wrong direction, you can shift your purchasing someplace else.
What's wrong with just doing it domestically?
We can do it domestically. It would be, I mean, one of the things that I see as being a problem is that if you pull everything back into our borders, then it would actually make us not work, there would not be a need to work with other nations.
And what's bad about that?
Well, whenever there's been a situation in the past in which that you have sort of big fault lines between industrial systems, often you end up with wars along those fault lines. So the issue is like, what is a smart amount of interdependence? What's a smart amount of cooperation where if someone starts to screw up, you can pull away from that person?
But Barry Lynn, if author of The End of the Line, if you go back and read Adam Smith, and I'm guessing that you probably have, The Wealth of Nations in 1776. And he makes a very clear point, and David Ricardo later makes a very clear point that the purpose of international trade is to get what you can't produce. It's not to create alliances. It's not to nurture democracy. It's not to support friends here and there. And it's certainly not to enrich multinational corporations. In fact, that's what we fought the Revolutionary War against, was to get the British East India Company out of our business. It is the example that Adam Smith uses, if my recollection is correct, it's been 20 years, was something like, you know, you had one country that grows great grapes and they can make wine. You got another country that has good milk and they can make cheese. And you got another country that has sheep and they can make wool sweaters. And none of the other three countries have all three of those things. So if they trade with each other, then everybody can have, you know, can drink a glass of wine with their cheese while they're wearing a sweater. But if any one of those countries, or if all three of those countries, for example, are all making good wine, then there's no reason to trade with each other.
I actually agree, and actually, if you look at the way I wrote the book, I mean, I make all those points in the book. One of the things that if you also look at the end of the book, one of the things that points I make is that actually, if we basically cap the amount of dependence that we would sort of put place on China, that we say, you know, we're not going to rely on China for more than 25% of anything. And then one of the things that would immediately happen is you would end up stemming the flow of jobs out of the country. You'd actually probably end up repatriating.
Well, that's what I was just saying. Why be dependent upon them for 25%? It sounds to me like you're still in the Thomas Friedman, you know, let the multinational corporations' highest interest be our highest interest camp rather than what's best for the United States.
No, I mean, Tom Friedman is the exact opposite. Tom Friedman would say, like, let us, you know, 100% reliance on another nation is absolutely fine.
I know.
What I'm
hearing you say is that 25% is just fine, and I'm saying, why not say that if there are domestic industries that are essential to our security, number one, that they're going to be here, period, and we're going to put in tariffs that are going to prevent them from going someplace else, and secondly, if there are industries that are useful to us to have, that we're going to support those industries. I mean, it was 1787 was when Tench Knox passed the first tariffs, quote, to protect domestic industries, end quote.
I actually want to, you know, the points you're making, I think they're absolutely 100% valid points. So one of the things with my book is what I always say is that it's important not to look too much at my set of solutions. But, you know, 95% of my book is an analysis of where we are now. And what my analysis shows is that where we are now is untenable, it is unsustainable, and we have to change it somehow, some way. Now, I have like a... So then, you know, what I would really like to do is get to the point where, you know, I'm debating you on the other side of where we are now. Or Tom Friedman, you know, well, Tom Friedman wouldn't be there at that point. But where, you know, this debate that we're having right now is a necessary debate. It's an important debate. And the first thing we need to understand is that where we are now cannot last. Where we are now is going to lead us to a disaster of, you know, unprecedented proportions. So, you know, the initial thing is we have to basically tell our, the leadership in Washington, we have to demand that we begin to treat our production system, the global production system, in an entirely new way. We have to abandon this laissez-faire model that we've pursued.
Well, then you're really not talking about an entirely new way. You're talking about going back to the old way. I mean, we used protective tariffs in the United States from 1787 up until basically George Herbert Walker Bush, was pushing for fast track authority. You could take it back to Nixon, really, in some ways, but it really picked up steam under Reagan, Bush Sr., and Bill Clinton.
Bush tried to take off the controls, but the Democratic Congress prevented him.
I know.
Clinton came in and he squashed.
Yeah, he kicked the door wide open. By saying you have to get. Absolutely, I'm right there with you. But why not say we had a system here that built one of the most powerful and rich, wealthy nations in the world by our own riches. We did it largely internally, and now what we've done is we've reinvented slave labor. We've just simply exported it. We're not looking at our slaves any longer. It's like we're back to the 19th century having slave labor. It's just that they happen to be in China.
Well, I disagree with that somewhat. I lived for a long time in South America. I traveled a lot in Asia. I spent half a year in India at one point. And one of the things I've lived
and worked in all those places.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've seen in many cases in which, industry actually comes in and it actually helps these nations to develop. And the more these nations develop, not all these people are slaves. Some of these people have very good jobs, are doing very well. The key is so that they're not set in direct competition with us. There's no reason for them to be in competition for us. That is an outrage.
Well, and the thing is, when American industry comes into one of those countries, then they're set up. They're in the same subservient position. I mean, as a nation, they're in that position where American industry now controls their nation, and you have entire nations whose national policies are being historically have been defined by the United States.
Yeah,
I mean, the countries that have been captives of Dole pineapple, of Dole fruit, and the American Fruit Corporation, and the sugar companies and things. I'm sorry, I don't see that as a good thing.
Well, I mean,
if a domestic corporation starts up, some in-house, and they're saying, we're going to have some business here, let's do it.
There certainly are a number of instances, and especially early in the first half of the century, in which American corporations really exploited nations. They actually ended up almost capturing control over the politics in certain nations, especially smaller nations in this hemisphere. And, that is absolutely unacceptable. But I think that we have to understand that there is a middle ground where Americans and Indians and Chinese and Mexicans and Brazilians and Europeans can actually all work together in a system that promotes the well-being of everyone. And what we have now is not doing that, obviously. And that's the thing. We have to understand that just because this system isn't working, we don't have to flip all the way back to the other side.
Why not?
I actually think that by flipping all the way back, we'd end up in a situation in which that would also be destabilizing. Right now, we're destabilizing. If we go all the way back, that would be destabilizing.
All the way back to the system that worked so well for this country for 200 years?
We actually had a global system. Everyone looks at globalization as something that started in the 1990s. We had a global system that worked from 1947 until 1993 when Bill Clinton just decided to outsource control of the global economy to the private sector. From 1947 until 1993, we had a system that totally integrated the United States and Japan, United States and Europe, United States and Taiwan, and it worked for all those nations together.
Okay, if people want more information, they can check out the book. Barry C. Lynn, End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation. And your website again, Barry, was?
The best information is at newamerica.net.
Newamerica.net. Thank you, Barry.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Keep up the good work. Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Sick and tired of hearing things from outside, short-sighted, narrow-minded, hypocrites. All is the truth.
Ah, yes, I'd like some truth, please. Well, you see, you got to understand who you're dealing with here in the Bush administration. Michael Chertoff, the director of Human Services, in my dreams, the director of the Department of Homeland Security, DHS chief, Michael Chertoff, was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert on Sunday. He says the only reason for delay in getting federal aid to Katrina was that everyone thought the crisis was over. Well, to quote him verbatim, he said, and I quote, "I remember on Tuesday morning picking up newspapers and I saw headlines, New Orleans dodged the bullet," end quote. So some of the folks over at the Wonkette blog said, wonder what newspaper it was that ran a headline that said New Orleans dodged the bullet. Now, he said newspapers, plural, so it'd be nice if you could find a couple of them. Then you'd know what Michael Chertoff reads, I suppose. They went off on a search. He lives in Washington, D.C. The Washington Post, the headline, "Storm Trashes Gulf Coast." Pictures, absolutely vivid photos of massive destruction and houses half underwater. The New York Times, a headline, "Hurricane slams into Gulf Coast, dozens are dead." Another picture of literally houses with water up to their second floor windows. Maybe he reads the Washington Times. You know that right-wing publication? "Katrina pounds Gulf Coast." That's the headline. "Big Easy flooded," the subhead. 50 dead in Mississippi. Well, maybe he went online and read the Times-Picayune from New Orleans. Don't think so. The headline there in 72-point type, inch-tall letters, "Catastrophic." Storm surges, swamp, Ninth Ward, St. Bernard, Lakeview levee breach threatens to inundate city. Those were the headlines. And the folks over at Wonkette searched as well as they could. The museum has over 400 front pages archived. Not one single one said New Orleans dodged the bullet. Not one. So why does Michael Chertoff go on national television and say, we thought they dodged the bullet because we read that in the papers? Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Janice, what's on your mind today?
Tom, this is really a privilege to be able to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
It's a privilege
to have you on. What's up?
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that you don't argue with people who don't agree with you. I just don't scream at them. You don't scream at them. Exactly. And you're very educational. But what I wanted to say is, did you see on TV how they keep talking about this national catastrophe fund that the insurance companies want us all to pay into?
Right.
So they want to get, so maybe that's why they made FEMA so, you know, ineffective. So
well, yeah, I don't think that they made FEMA ineffective. I mean, they made FEMA ineffective by not believing in government and by being total screw-ups. I mean, this is the story of the Bush administration. After 9/11, Bush is running around the country, flying all over the country trying to hide out. It took him a whole day to get back to Washington, D.C., maybe longer than that. I don't recall exactly, but I know he made several stops before he ended up in Washington. And then, you know, in New York, he tells his Christy Todd Whitman with the Environmental Protection Agency to lie to people about the air quality so that they can keep people working down there.
Right.
These guys, they don't believe in government as being we the people in order to protect we the people. They just don't believe in it. And that's why they're screwing this stuff up.
Have you spoken about what Howard Dean...
I did, and I'm going to get back to it after this break.
Oh, good. And I also want you to know that not only am I active, but my whole family is active. My kids, 16 and 11, are active. So I think that, you know, we as Americans have to also impart this knowledge to our children because, you know, they don't want our kids to know this stuff either.
Yeah, and there's another generation coming up. And you know, those of us who remember what it was like before Reagan are starting to die off.
Exactly. Thank you so much.
Okay, Janice, you're not only active, you've been on the radio. Now you're radioactive.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call. Oh, my goodness, my goodness, my goodness. In fact, this here, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the midnight headlights find you on a rainy night street.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, we got to keep rolling. What's the alternative? There is none. Welcome back. It is 33 and a half minutes past the hour. Leave it to the folks in the chat room. I mean, they are just, by the way, you can get to our chat room, our live chat room, by going to tomhartman.com and clicking live chat. Here's the headline. The Grenada Star, the Daily Star, it's online, Z-Wire, zwire.com. Big Easy dodges bullet. So maybe Michael Chertoff was reading online. By Adam Nossiter, associated press writer. It might have even been carried in some newspapers. Hurricane Katrina plowed into this below-sea-level city Monday with shrieking 145-mile-an-hour winds. Bloody oh, the storm unleashed more chaos as it moved into Mississippi. Katrina weakened, goes, but destruction was everywhere along the Gulf Coast, including an estimated 40,000 homes flooded in St. Bernard Parish. Apparently all Chertoff read was the headline. Katrina retarded a storm surge of at least 20 feet in Mississippi, where windows of a major hospital were blown out, utility poles dangled in the wind, casinos were flooded. In Alabama, exploding transformers lit up the early morning sky. Gulfport Fire Chief Pat Sullivan, let me tell you something, folks. I've been out there. It's complete devastation. Yeah, I'd say it's pretty clear that the Governor Haley Barbour, we know some people got trapped and we pray they're okay. National Hurricane Center Director Max Mayfield warned that New Orleans would be pounded throughout the day and that Katrina's potential 15-foot storm surge, down from a feared 28, was still enough to cause extensive flooding. So, well, looks like our esteemed Homeland Security Chief just read the headline. Yeah, what can you say? Anyhow, thanks to, I believe it was Roy in the chat room for passing that along. The timeline, yesterday somebody had called and said, is there a timeline on this thing out there? And yeah, Wikipedia is actually putting one together. And several folks were kind enough to email it to me, point it out to me. And very straightforward, August 23rd, the National Hurricane Center issues a statement saying that Tropical Depression 12 has formed over the southeastern Bahamas. On the 24th, it's upgraded to Tropical Storm Katrina, the fourth hurricane of the season. It hits Florida that day, kills 11 people. On the 27th, it's upgraded to a Cat 3 hurricane, Category 3. On August 27th, President Bush declares a state of emergency in Louisiana. We should add, on August 26th, the governor of Louisiana declares a state of emergency in Louisiana and requests that George Bush do the same. On August 27th, Bush does it. On August 27th, the National Weather Service issues a bulletin predicting devastating damage. On August 28th, mandatory evacuation is ordered for New Orleans City. Category 5, hurricane becomes Category 5. It's still out at sea. August 28th. August 29th, 6 a.m., makes landfall near Grand Isle, Louisiana as a Cat 4 hurricane, maximum sustained winds of 145 miles an hour, and then makes landfall near Louisiana-Mississippi border. August 30th, CNN reports that a levee on the 17th Street Canal, which connects into Lake Pontchartrain, suffered a two-city-block-wide breach. It is later reported that a total of three levees are breached. This is August 30th. On August 30th, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin announces that the planned sandbagging of the 17th Street levee breach has failed. 80% of New Orleans is underwater. Instances of looting are being reported. August 31st, the following day. Now, 80% of New Orleans is underwater. The next day, August 31st, President Bush heads back to Washington from vacation in Crawford, Texas, although he does not stop in Louisiana. Air Force One flies over the Gulf Coast so he can view the devastation. August 31, he declares the Gulf Coast a public health emergency. August 31, Kathleen Blanco, the governor of Louisiana, orders that all of New Orleans, including the Superdome, be evacuated. September 1, they start moving folks out. By September 4, the Superdome is completely evacuated. By September 5, The 17th Street Canal levee is breaches plugged with 3,000-pound sandbags. It's just the very, very, very bare bones. Just the start. Just a very bare bones outline of this thing. So what's going on with regard to this? Well, you've got now the Republicans. You know, it's almost disrespectful to say the Republicans, because there are Republicans who are horrified about this, as Ellen Ratner reported in the second hour of our program from Washington, D.C. You have the Karl Rove bunch, which is the Bush administration and right-wing talk radio. You have them out there saying, don't look at that man behind the curtain. Instead, look at Ray Nagin. He's the one you need to be paying attention to. Or Kathleen Blanco. It's all her fault. Let's look at the governor. She's got to be the one that we hold accountable. Or maybe those poor black people in New Orleans. They're the ones that we should hold accountable. The president? No. You don't want to hold the president accountable. Can't have that. No, sorry. Hold the president? No. It's got to be the poor people in New Orleans. You know, they could have left. They chose to stay there. Just ask Bill O'Reilly. Just ask Rush Limbaugh. This is a proof of the failure of the welfare state. But, you know, don't you know? I mean, Rush Limbaugh will tell you if somebody is black, they must be on welfare. This is so sick. Anyhow, you got the Republicans out there with their talking points that local officials didn't do their job. They didn't fill out the right paperwork. You had a senior administration official leaking to the Washington Post a story saying, quote, this was in the article, many evacuated, many thousands still waiting. White House shifts blame to state and local officials. The Washington Post, as of Saturday, September 3rd, Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco still had not declared a state emergency. Turns out that was not true. It was just plain old flat out wrong. It was a plain old flat out lie. And the Washington Post was fed this lie by a senior administration official. That's what they quoted. They quoted a senior administration official. And who might that senior administration official be?
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah. So there we got the... of course, that was about another... That was Karl Rove, was that one, right? We now know. Karl Rove, the patriot who committed treason against his country and is still sitting and working in the White House. What's wrong with this picture? On Sunday, August 28th. I mean, this is another one of the Republican talking points. We didn't anticipate this. No one could have known, right? No one could have known, George Bush says. This is what the National Weather Service posted on their website. This is what they fed to radio stations all across the country. This is what they fed to FEMA. This is what they fed to the state. This is what they fed to the federal government. This is what the Bush administration heard about what might happen. 4:13 p.m. Central Daylight Time, Sunday, August 28, 2005. Extremely dangerous Hurricane Katrina continues to approach the Mississippi River Delta. Devastating damage expected. Most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least half of well-constructed homes will have roof and wall failure. All gabled roofs will fail, leaving these homes severely damaged or destroyed. The majority of industrial buildings will become non-functional. Partial to complete wall and roof failure is expected. All wood-framed low-rise apartment buildings will be destroyed. Concrete block low-rise apartments will sustain major damage, including some wall and roof failure. High-rise office and apartment buildings will sway dangerously, a few to the point of total collapse. All windows will blow out. Airborne debris will be widespread and may include heavy items such as household appliances and even light vehicles. Sport utility vehicles and light trucks will be moved. The blown debris will create additional destruction. Persons, pets, and livestock exposed to the winds will face certain death if struck. Power outages will last for weeks as most power poles will be down and transformers destroyed. Water shortages will make human suffering incredible by modern standards. The vast majority of native trees will be snapped or uprooted. Only the hardiest will remain standing but be totally defoliated. Few crops will remain. Livestock left exposed to the winds will be killed. An inland hurricane wind watch is issued when sustained winds near hurricane force or frequent gusts at or above hurricane force are possible within the next 24 to 36 hours. That's the kind of the caveat at the end that says this is what we're saying to you. Sunday, August 28th, 4:13 p.m., the release of the National Weather Service. Oh, we couldn't have expected this. And that was when Ray Nagin, the governor, the mayor of New Orleans, said, okay, that's it. Evacuate the city, and if you can't get out of the city, go to the Superdome. Do not stay in your house. But the Bushies, the talking points, the number one talking point, local officials, they didn't cross their T's and dot their I's. They didn't fill out the paperwork. They didn't respond quickly enough. What are you supposed to do? You order an evacuation. Well, what about all those school buses? Well, okay. You got 100,000 people to evacuate. You can carry maybe 10,000 in the school buses. Who gets on first? And how are they going to get out of there? And do they have enough fuel in them? And who's going to drive them? And you know, I mean, we can second guess this thing forever. But the reality is that Nagin did issue an evacuation order. A mandatory evacuation order, did say get out of town, and did organize a place for people to go, and those who went there survived by and large. But no, that's not good enough. John Kerry, he was a war hero. They smeared him. They swift boated him. John McCain, he's a war hero. His wife and he adopt a child from Bangladesh. No, they got to smear them. Karl Rove running push polls in South Carolina during the 2000 primaries, calling up people saying, if you learned that brown-skinned child that is John McCain's child was actually his out-of-wedlock love child with an African-American woman, would it change your proclivity to vote for him, your tendency to vote for him? Yes or no? And Karl Rove says, well, we never told people that child was an out-of-wedlock child. We just asked them if it would change their mind. We have to support our president in this time of crisis, they say. If you don't support your president, you must hate America. I'm sorry, I love America, and that's why I cannot support this president. And it goes on and on and on. So this is the Republican talking points have caused Howard Dean, and Howard Dean, you know, absolutely, in my mind, Howard Dean gets the award. I just have to say, Howard Dean, you know, our jolly good fellow for the day. Right? There you go. Our jolly good fellow. Howard Dean says, and I quote, based on today's reports, it seems clear that President Bush's visit is just another callous political move crafted by Karl Rove. It's just appalling to see how quickly President Bush and Karl Rove have mobilized a political strategy in their own defense, but simply failed to mobilize a swift response to either keep the people in the Gulf Coast region safe in the first place or aid the victims in the aftermath of the storm. Thousands of people lost their lives. Our nation faces difficult times as we address the painful aftermath of Katrina. Yet President Bush is worried about shifting blame and passing the buck? Shouldn't we be worried about restoring stability, plans to evacuate survivors, and ensuring that our communities have the resources they need to help the victims of this tragedy rebuild their lives? Now is the time for leadership, not partisanship. This is one failure we will not allow Rove and the GOP attack machine to spin away with their usual barrage of photo ops, misinformation, smear campaigns, and press conferences. End of quote. Thank you, Howard Dean. Thank you, Howard Dean. Absolutely well said. As the Center for American Progress notes, true to form, the president's hatchet man, Karl Rove, began executing a public relations effort over this last weekend to shift blame for the administration's failures in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina onto hard-pressed state and local officials in New Orleans and Louisiana. The Bush administration was supposed to take full responsibility for coordinating rescue and relief efforts days before Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. That's what declaring an emergency, a federal emergency, is all about. And George Bush actually did declare that emergency. On August 27th, the declaration on the White House website, it authorizes the Department of Homeland Security Federal Emergency Management Agency to coordinate all disaster relief efforts. The order specifies that, quote, FEMA is authorized to identify, mobilize, and provide at its discretion equipment and resources necessary to alleviate the impacts of the emergency. Jane Bullock, former FEMA chief of staff, said the moment the president declared a federal disaster, it became a federal responsibility. That was August 27, before the hurricane hit. As she said, the federal government took ownership over the response. 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
Sitting in the morning sun.
Oh, you tell them, Otis.
I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
You know, sometimes we all need to just relax.
On the dock of the bay, wasting time.
Get a little perspective here. Yeah, well said. Welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour. Well, 4 minutes before the hour now. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia on the line. Hey, Steve, thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. I'm talking. Well, yeah, I'm starting to get the feeling down here in the South. You know, a lot of these Republicans are really starting to wake up, or at least just shut up. you know, went over to dinner with my my wife's parents on Labor Day, and, you know, they're kind of, you know, your basic conservative Republicans, and, you know, I was trying to figure out a way to just kind of ease into what happened and everything, and, you know, without putting too much of a damper on the whole Labor Day.
Yeah, it's never fun to argue politics with in-laws.
No, so I just said...
From experience.
That's right. So I just said, man, Bush really just screwed this one up, didn't he? And so that didn't go over too well, but no. They always are concentrating on this, you know, mayor evacuation thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The point you made was really good about, you know, FEMA took over. But, you know, I always just say, hey, the mayor got them through the hurricane.
Yeah,
you know,
many
he,
of them. Unfortunately,
them,
I mean, there were a lot of people who couldn't move, and there are a lot of people
mm-hmm.
who wouldn't move.
Right.
And many of those people died. And we're only beginning to get the leading edge of this tragedy. And fortunately or unfortunately, I was going to say unfortunately, but I suppose it's arguable. But now the federal government has stepped in, and they have ordered a mandatory evacuation of the city, which means that if you're in the city without permission of federal military, of FEMA, you know, of the federalized force, then they can shoot you, which means that reporters are all going to be driven out of the city. And now that FEMA has said no more pictures of dead bodies, none. So, you know, we're going to find something like possibly 10,000 bodies, not one picture. No flag-draped caskets coming back from Iraq, and no dead bodies coming back from New Orleans.
No visual to influence public opinion.
There you go. And actually, they want visuals to influence public opinion. They took 50 firefighters who volunteered to help out down there, and they flew them down for a photo op with George W. Bush. But that's it. That's the only visual. Steve, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Oh, my goodness. Yes, it was the 28th of August when Ray Nagin and Kathleen Blanco turned the city of New Orleans over to the federal government. And George said, what? Me worry? And went off to eat cake with John McCain and then play the guitar with a country western star. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you again tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.